This is the takeaway for Tuesday, March 6, 2018. Thanks for downloading the podcast, and if you haven't already, please subscribe.
You're hearing there the opening of the National People's Congress in Beijing this week. Nearly 3,000 Communist Party delegates from across China gathering for the two-week summit. But you're also hearing the ceremony overlaying a remarkable consolidation of power in China's leadership. President Xi Jinping announced he's abolishing term limits for his presidency, and this clears the way for Xi to stay in power indefinitely, even though it was his father who helped draft the constitution that set term limits in the first place in 1982. We got reaction from Chinese citizens living and studying in the United States. Cheryl only wanted us to use her first name.
If Xi Jinping is trying to be the emperor of China, the political situation for citizens and netizens would be worse. But we shouldn't forget that the current situation is really bad already. We should remind ourselves that as long as the Communist Party is in control of China, nothing is a better situation, no matter who the president is and how long he could be the president.
We also heard from Shaunavel Kong, a freshman at Temple University.
I know term limits is kind of like a small ideal, but having a term limit creates a bigger picture for the people and the citizens of a country. And China's ratification of eliminating term limits, it destroyed any ounce of China ever having a democratic government.
So to me, I think this move is actually sending out a very strong political signal, which I don't know exactly what it is, but it is quite alarming.
That's Tony. He also wanted us to use only his first name. He just completed his graduate studies at Columbia University in New York.
I am definitely concerned. The most direct impact on me is that in the past week, I have at least 20 friends on social media got silenced or their accounts got deleted altogether only because they uttered disagreement and sometimes just alluded that this change might not be the best thing in the world.
Increased censorship on social media and more broadly online, signs of growing authoritarianism in China. So what happens if Xi effectively becomes, as President Trump said, president for life? I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway. Mary Gallagher is professor of political science and director of the Lieberthal-Rogol Center for Chinese Studies at the University of Michigan. She's watching the People's Congress in Beijing and what President Xi's political moves could mean for a China trying to reorder its economy and increase its reach across the world. Mary, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Mary, a lot of people have been speculating over President Xi's true motivations for getting rid of term limits in the Constitution. What do you read in this situation?
Well, Xi Jinping has been a strong leader since he first took office in 2012, and he's, I think, impressed a lot of people at his ability to centralize power even before this move to remove term limits. It's been justified as a way to allow him to continue the reforms that he's doing internally and also for him to continue to project China's power globally. It's also been justified that having term limits created a kind of lame duck situation for leaders in their second term. And so this is another sort of justification for allowing Xi now to rule indefinitely.
And what do they gain by consolidating this power in the hands of one person and effectively saying that his leadership could go on for the next 20 years?
I think the party believes that what it will gain is a decisive leader at a period of time where China has to make some very critical decisions and difficult reforms. And so I do think there is a portion of people within the party and maybe also among the citizens that think it's a good thing that Xi Jinping, who seems decisive and resolute and is going to lead China through this difficult period. At the same time, I think many people are more worried about the change in the rule itself, because Xi Jinping now at the current age versus Xi Jinping at, say, 85 is a totally different situation.
We heard from Tony at the top, who said that several of his friends had their social media accounts essentially shut off for uttering even displeasure with the news of unlimited terms for President Xi at the Party Congress. Is that the incentive for Xi Jinping now? More authoritarianism and sort of ideological purging and kind of a stamping out of dissent back home?
I think it makes it, I mean, if he is interested in doing these reforms, which I think we assume he is, then the reason to silence dissent is to make it such that he can go forward with these plans and to not have any voiced opposition.
What about things that China wants to accomplish out in the world? Another aspect of Chinese policy now that's getting reported is an 8% increase in military spending. China hasn't revealed the details of where that 8% goes, but that's a lot.
Yeah, China's military budget has been growing at a similar rate for many years. And so this increase, this current announced increase this year is not particularly different, but it's just part of this trend of China's expanding military power. Previous leaders since Deng Xiaoping in the 1980s had this idea of China needed to bide its time. So China needed to sort of keep its head down, get stronger economically, keep political stability internally, and sort of not get too involved in big global issues. That's completely changed under Xi Jinping. So Xi Jinping has this idea of Belt and Road Initiative, which is building out infrastructure in places all over the world, but particularly Central Asia and South Asia and connecting to places like Europe. He also has expanded China's military power in the South China Sea. And I think also just generally, given the current situation, both in U.S. and European politics, which are very inward focused, really dealing with sort of internal division and polarization, Xi Jinping sees this as a kind of moment of opportunity.
And Mary, before we have to run, looking over the next 2 years, let's say, as Americans watch the situation in China, some things get in the news internationally and some things don't. What should we be looking for, in your view, from China that will suggest the first effects of this new power on the part of Xi Jinping?
I think given the possibility from both social media and from sort of rumors that are coming out about elite dissension about this change, it's possible that what we might actually experience is, rather than a lot of resolute policymaking, is perhaps a kind of policy paralysis where local government officials and other party officials simply don't act as quickly as they might because they want to indicate that this policy is something they're not in favor of. The other possibility, I think, for President Xi is that he now needs to justify taking on this indefinite presidency. And there may be actually more pressure on him within the next 5 years to continue Chinese growth and to continue making people happy. And that means perhaps also avoiding some of the difficult reforms that the government is planning to do.
Mary Gallagher with the University of Michigan on China's march forward under Xi Jinping. Mary, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the main items on Xi Jinping's international agenda, China's at times tense patron relationship with North Korea. And there's news now from the North. The government of Kim Jong-un has apparently told officials from South Korea that it's willing to talk about abandoning its nuclear and ballistic missile programs in exchange for security guarantees from the United States. South Korea also says the North has agreed to a summit meeting along the two countries' shared border that'll take place next month. It's the first meeting of its kind in more than a decade. Now, this all comes after South Korean officials visited Pyongyang and spoke directly with Kim Jong-un. Is this new light in the darkening relationship between North Korea and South Korea and its American ally? Charles Armstrong is professor of Korean studies at Columbia University in New York. Charles, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Well, Charles, things started warming around the Winter Olympics, all kind of choreographed for sure between North Korea and South Korea. But how significant is this latest news? Do you buy it that this is a serious overture from the North?
Well, this could be a very big deal. The North Koreans have been sending strong messages to South Korea since the new year that they want to improve their relations and also to reach out to the U.S. By sending his sister, who's a very trusted aide, Kim Jong-un was telling the South Koreans that he's very serious about this. And then when the South Korean delegation went to Pyongyang, from what I understand, they were quite surprised to actually have a personal audience with Kim Jong-un, much less for Kim Jong-un to make such statements that he did, that he's willing to come to a summit with the South Korean leader, that he's willing to talk to the U.S. ultimately about giving up nuclear weapons. So we'll see how far this goes, but this is the first ray of light we've seen on this issue in a very long time.
Well, that ray of light, President Trump tweeted that this was possible progress in a serious effort, but that it could also be false hope. The president has been all over the map, from fire and fury to portraying a willingness to talk to North Korea. What kinds of security guarantees would North Korea be looking for in exchange for denuclearizing?
Well, that's not clear. There have been talks about security guarantees going back to the Clinton administration, and North Korea continuously says that the U.S. has to drop its hostile policy toward Pyongyang, but it's not clear exactly how that would take place. What we do know, however, and what is a positive sign for now, is that the North Koreans have said they will restrain themselves from any missile and nuclear testing while talks are going on. So we'll have to see where these go, but it's a good beginning.
And what kind of details do we have about this April summit itself? What should our expectations be? It'll be on the border, neutral ground between North and South Korea. But this is preliminary, right? The U.S. wouldn't be there, I don't take it. So North Korea is not going to give up its nukes in April, right?
No, North Korea would only agree to something like that in direct talks with the U.S. And even then, it would probably say this is a long-term goal, not anything that's going to happen soon. This is nothing new for North Korea, actually. They've been talking for years about giving up nukes eventually or having a denuclearized Korean peninsula as their long-term goal. So it's not going to happen anytime soon. As for the April summit, it's quite surprising that this would be something Pyongyang would agree to. First of all, it's the third summit between North and South Korean leaders, but the first one that won't take place in Pyongyang. So this will be on neutral ground. This is a very important symbolic gesture that the leader of North Korea is not bringing in the South Korean leader as a kind of inferior partner or someone to make a pilgrimage to Pyongyang, but actually meeting on kind of neutral territory as more or less equals. And we'll see how this goes. But this is intended as a North-South Korean summit, not anything that would involve the U.S. or any other third partner.
And Charles, what's the top item on the table between North and South for their April summit that might signal significant progress and a chance to move even further here?
Well, I think clearly the North Koreans want to send a message to the U.S. through South Korea. They're going to talk about specifically inter-Korean issues like family reunions and economic exchange and things like that. But we could look for North Korea offering to go back to an earlier inter-Korean denuclearization agreement from 1991 and saying that South Korea and the U.S., if they scale down their military exercises, which will have started by then, that North Korea will enter into talks. So we'll see what happens. The focus will be on specifically inter-Korean issues, North-South issues, but North Korea is clearly using this as a platform to send a message to the U.S., that they're willing to talk about the nuclear issue.
Charles Armstrong, professor of Korean studies at Columbia University. Thanks, Charles.
You're welcome.
One of the great things about Panama, not only the beautiful building, but the incredible views. The building was situated so it has these fabulous views. And boy, do we take advantage of that situation.
That's President Donald Trump in a promotional video from 2011, before he was president, making the grand opening of the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Panama City. And here's some sound from that very same hotel just yesterday. That is the sound of workers chipping away the TRUMP Trump sign from the hotel's facade. Because in the 7 years since that hotel first opened, what was once a promising real estate investment for the Trump organization has gone south. Businessman Orestes Fintiklis became the majority owner of that hotel last August. He's been trying to push the Trump organization out since October. And on Monday, Fintiklis, with the help of authorities in Panama, achieved a momentary victory. And he celebrated that victory by playing a song for reporters on a piano in the hotel lobby. Orestes Orestes Fentiklis celebrating his victory over the Trump Organization in the lobby of his hotel. Jeff Horowitz is investigative reporter for the Associated Press, and he breaks down what's been going on in Panama City.
Orestes Fentiklis, who is a Miami-based private equity fund manager, bought a majority of the hotel, 202 of the 369 units last August. And originally, the plan was for the Trump people to continue managing the property as usual. And in fact, the Trump people had even gotten a commitment that Orestes would not challenge that. And that seems to have evaporated as there were concerns as to whether the Trump people were mismanaging the property or skimming money allegedly from the property or something of that nature. So we got this fight going, and it escalated first 2 weeks ago when Fentiklis tried to take control of the actual property by firing the management, because they do work for the hotel and he is the owner of the hotel association. The Trump people refused, and that set off a series of clashes, sometimes physical. Literally, there was a brawl in a stairwell as the police were called, and both sides basically vied for control of the property. And on Monday, what happened is Fentiklis got the Panamanian legal system on his side.
Why does Orestes Fentiklis want to push the Trump family out now? What's going on with the business of the hotel?
So the thing that was his line throughout this, I guess, was that this was a terrible, terrible business arrangement, that the Trump brand was ruined, particularly in Latin America, given Trump's statements regarding Latin American nations, and also that the actual management on the ground was poor, and he also alleged that there was some financial misconduct. So the idea was that basically as long as the property was in Trump's control, there would be no return to profitability, and the owners were losing their shirts.
So, Jeff, Orestes Fentiklis has called the Trumps leeches because they won't go from the hotel. The Trumps have accused him, you mentioned it, of mob-style tactics, of being a thug. I got to say, the whole thing kind of reminds you a little bit of The Godfather, the Corleone family trying to push out Mo Green when the hotel that they're in on together is losing money. I hate to connect it to something like that, but I read this story and it reminds me of that movie.
I'm trying to think which one, which side would be the Godfather side in this. I'm not entirely sure, the Mo Green side. This was obviously a conflict between two very, very stubborn sides. The thing that Orestes Fentiklis had going for him is that his side is actually the owner of the property, and Trump had a management contract, and Fentiklis wanted that contract to be over, or at least wanted Trump to be out. Now, there's still going to be plenty of fighting in arbitration and in New York courts over the terms of that contract and whether contractual violations occurred by dumping the Trump brand. But in terms of physical control of the property, it is Fentiklis's property, flat out. He's the majority owner of the building and the head of the Owners Association.
What's going on with the Trump Organization and its branded hotels more broadly? This is the Panama situation. The Trump Soho, just a couple of blocks from our studios in New York, recently lost the Trump name. Owners shed the Trump name there. Another hotel in Toronto. Is this a pattern?
So Trump, for a long time, was in a very lucrative business of licensing his brand and then taking a management contract from a hotel. So he basically didn't have to take any risk in building the thing. He never had any skin in the game, but it was a great business. It was a great branding business. And what you're seeing now is properties that actually paid top dollar. I mean, in the case of Panama, literally tens of millions of dollars for Donald Trump's name and brand and imprimatur are now getting into expensive and nasty fights trying to get him out of the property. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that. Definitely, the president's image worldwide has not been good for his brand in terms of Latin America and Canada and so forth. And it's, I guess, the sort of thing where just the owners simply decided that this was not a good business association to be associated with Trump.
And Jeff, how much of this has to do with politics? I mean, the Trump Organization's point man in Panama says this is a business dispute, has nothing to do with the presidency whatsoever. But it's also probably true that you and I are talking about this because the company is called the Trump Organization and not the Jones Organization. How much does politics feed into this?
It's most of it, I would say. Donald Trump's popularity worldwide is not high, and particularly not in Latin America. Panamanians have definitely taken some of Trump's rhetoric regarding immigration to be personally. It's worth considering that Trump is currently working to send hundreds of thousands of Central American immigrants home. And it's the sort of thing, I think, that made it so that, as one owner of the property down there in Panama put it to me, this is not Orestes Fintiklis, with Trump here, there is no high season, right? This is supposed to be the peak of the year, and simply the name was toxic.
And at this point, at the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Panama City, Jeff, that name has been chiseled off the sign. For now, has Orestes Fintiklis basically won and moved Trump out?
So, yes, absolutely. The Panamanian judicial system really does seem to have weighed in here in terms of his actual physical control of the property. Now, what Panama has made very clear is that it can't weigh in on the contractual disputes. That stuff's under New York law, and that is something that there are, you know, legal claims worth tens or hundreds of millions of dollars outstanding, and who knows how that's going to play out. It's a completely separate track. So the Trump people have definitely lost this battle, potentially not the war.
Jeff Horowitz, investigative reporter for the Associated Press. Jeff, thanks.
Thank you.
Deliberate acts of gun violence generate headlines, sometimes, in America. But in 2017, there were more than 2,000 unintentional shootings in this country, many of them fatal. Some of these accidents are children playing with guns, some are adults mishandling them, and some are faulty weapons, guns that fire when dropped, or fire when the safety is on, or even go off while they're in the holster. An investigation by Bloomberg has uncovered one gun manufacturer called Taurus that has sold close to 1 million guns at risk of being defective.
You might notice reviews of Taurus say, oh, they're inexpensive, I can get it easily, I can find it on the resale market. So that's really their target demographic in America, is that cheap handgun market. And it's pretty widespread throughout the United States.
Polly Mossens is firearms industry reporter for Bloomberg. She covered a class action lawsuit where Taurus agreed to repair or buy back close to 1 million guns that had the potential to fire without anyone ever pulling the trigger. But for the family of Jared Brown, word that Taurus handguns were misfiring came too late.
Jared Brown had grown up in a household where gun safety was the norm. His stepmother had a firearm. She had a .38 revolver that she was licensed to use and carry in her purse. Jared grew up learning how to shoot. He shot a .22 rifle when he was 7 years old, and they drilled safety to his head on hunting trips and at the shooting range. And unfortunately, Jared died. He was shot in his femoral artery when he was holding the Taurus in a holster on his side, which is a direct proximity to the femoral artery, just so you can imagine that on somebody's body. And according to the family who filed a lawsuit after his death, he did not do anything to make this gun go off. They allege that it went off in the holster with the safety on, and unfortunately, Jared still bled out and died.
What does the universe look like in terms of Taurus guns that may have gone off unintentionally and injured or killed people?
So we actually see a fair amount of lawsuits in this space, and there are variations of the same thing. Sometimes the gun dropped and went off. In some cases, it was in the holster. In another case, you know, there was a police officer who was running with it. It dropped and went off that way. But in all of these cases, everyone alleges that they had the safety on. They were participating in owning a gun in the safest way possible, as they should. And despite that, the firearm still went off. And beyond just seeing these cases, we did see a settlement by Taurus, which said that we will take these guns back, we will fix them. However, they've not used the word recall, and they're very adamant that nothing is wrong. And that's what they've said repeatedly. That's what they've said in court. That's what they've said when we contacted them for the story. It's just a settlement. It's not technically a recall.
What kind of guns made by Taurus are still out there in the world that might be defective or dangerous?
So there were 9 gun models that were alleged to be defective and were part of that settlement, and Taurus did stop selling them. However, of course, there's a huge resale market for firearms, and some people might just not be aware of the settlement. And that line that was really impacted by the settlement was the Millennium line, which included the PT-111 Millennium, it included the PT-24/7, the PT-140. Most of those are handguns. And We're also seeing Mr. Michael Coleman in North Carolina, who is a veteran and a police officer. He says that the Rossi 38 special revolver that he purchased for his wife originally has its own defects. He's filed a lawsuit which alleges that the gun basically exploded in his hand and unfortunately injured him.
Well, the National Rifle Association, in addition to all of its political activities, is a major organization for gun safety. Have they said anything to members about potential concerns with Taurus guns?
We've not seen them say anything to members. And in particular, Mr. Brown was very frustrated with that. He asked, why didn't the NRA warn us? He said that he's a lifetime member of the NRA. He obviously believes in gun rights and gun safety. And he was very frustrated that he wasn't told by the NRA, either through a mailer, an email blast, anything of that nature, that there had been something wrong here. That's really an organization that he thought would warn him.
The NRA didn't warn Bud Brown that the Taurus gun his son was using was potentially defective. So when bad guns are on the market, who's responsible for alerting consumers? The government orders recalls for unsafe consumer products all the time. Cribs, toys, electric kettles can all get recalled. But it turns out when it comes to defective guns, the rules are different. Bloomberg's Polly Mossens has the history explaining why guns and ammunition are not regulated the way thousands of other consumer products are.
So the government has absolutely no jurisdiction when it comes to firearm safety. And that actually dates back to the 1970s when the Consumer Product Safety Commission was first being set up. And John Dingell, who is now known as a Democrat with a very popular Twitter account, at the time was a big proponent of the NRA, of Second Amendment rights, of hunting. He carried an A-plus rating from the NRA. He felt very strongly that we should not put firearms under the purview of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. It might be a backdoor to gun control. So as a result, there is no jurisdiction. We have the FDA, we have the Transportation Authority, we of course have the Consumer Product Safety Commission, but none of them have those same recall rights over firearms. It's really on companies to say, we made a mistake, we have to recall this, or it's on the court system to have a case go through and either a settlement happen or for the company to lose in court and then proceed with a recall.
There are regulatory agencies for consumer products, you just mentioned them, but there's also law enforcement for alcohol, tobacco, firearms, the ATF, other organizations. Is there no way for the government to go after a dangerous, faulty gun that might be hurting people?
There's no way right now. The ATF doesn't have jurisdiction. When we asked them about this, they just referred us to the Consumer Product Safety Commission and said, ask them questions. So what this really would take in order to change is an act by Congress in order to really change the fundamental nature of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And I think that would be a very widespread political debate.
Polly, you mentioned that one of the only routes of accountability here are lawsuits. There have been attempts to exempt gun manufacturers from liability lawsuits, or at least to limit their liability. What's the state of the law when it comes to suing a gun manufacturer for an unsafe product?
Because of the 2005 Shield Laws, it's often called, you actually can't hold a gun manufacturer liable for a crime committed using their firearm. However, that's just crimes committed using their firearms. When it comes to faulty or defective allegations, that's what you can take to court. You can still sue a gun maker if you believe that their product is faulty.
Polly, is the court system adequate accountability here for an allegedly defective product like this? You explain the history with John Dingell and what Congress has said about regulating guns as consumer products. What evidence do we have about whether using the court system and liability torts is an effective way to enforce safety here?
It depends on who you ask. If you go to those on the NRA side, they would say it's the best system because you're going to present all the evidence. There's going to be experts in the room. There'll be a jury and a judge, and they can really make that decision. Proper due process. On the other hand, if you ask somebody who has been injured or has had a relative die due to this, they would probably express frustration that there's not a more direct line. So I really think that it's hard to say what would be better, but it's what we have. And it's important to remember that bringing a lawsuit is not easy. It is expensive. It is time consuming. For some people, it can be emotionally draining, particularly if they have to relive their own injury or the injury of a loved one. But that's what we're working with right now. And the court system definitely sees these cases.
And is anyone in Congress in this era of new attention on gun laws making an argument to put guns under the rubric of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, along with children's cribs and Venetian blinds and crock pots?
That's not something that we've seen so far. But of course, we have to look at Congress as kind of a whole when we look at the gun control argument, right? We also haven't seen a bump stock ban pass yet. We haven't seen anything about a potential assault weapons ban passed. So I think we really have to look at the larger gun control debate there, right? It's not like we haven't seen any gun control discussed. We just haven't seen anything in regards to the Consumer Product Safety Commission discussed.
Polly Mossens, firearms industry reporter for Bloomberg. Polly, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
What happens when officers commit wrongdoing and face discipline? New reporting from BuzzFeed News suggests that in New York, hundreds of NYPD officers are patrolling the streets and making arrests, despite the fact they've been disciplined at times for serious crimes. BuzzFeed obtained secret records of a secret system where department leaders use an ill-defined adjudication regime for discipline. Kendall Taggart co-reported this story for BuzzFeed News, where she discovered severe violations on the records of officers still walking the beat. Kendall, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it sounds like a huge number, 319 police employees between 2011 and 2015, who apparently committed fireable offenses. You detail assault, misuse of weapons, drug dealing in some cases. What were some of the most egregious examples that you came across in your reporting?
I think the officer that struck me most, though I have to say there were a lot of surprises in reporting this story, was an officer named Raymond Marrero, who works in the Bronx in New York. And he threatened, he didn't threaten, he actually beat a man with a baton and sent that person to the hospital. He suffers risk of brain damage as a result. And then just a year later, he ended up handcuffing a prisoner and holding him down while other officers beat that person. He falsely denied that no physical attack had happened when he was asked about it by Internal Affairs. That was the kind of thing that I would have thought before reporting this story would get you in serious trouble with the NYPD. Instead, what happened is he's put on this kind of wonky term the NYPD calls dismissal probation and allowed to stay on the force.
You said Officer Raymond Marrero works in the Bronx. Works as in is still working in the Bronx.
Yeah, he is still on the force.
Is that common that somebody with a record like you described for Officer Marrero to still be working for the NYPD?
I think our reporting suggests that it's certainly the kind of thing that an officer can do and stay on the force. I don't know how common it is. We got secret records detailing disciplinary histories of hundreds of officers, like you said, but there are 50,000 employees for the New York City Police Department. So I feel like we only have a small window into what's really going on in the department. Claims that they cannot provide any detailed information, citing some state secrecy laws.
So there are lots of different kinds of cases detailed in your report, Kendall. Officers inappropriately firing weapons. You already described assault, a case of an officer selling prescription drugs to another undercover officer while he was off duty, apparently an attempted drug deal. What happens when these officers get caught? They're on file, so there is some disciplinary action. Now, you mentioned something wonky called dismissal probation. Seems to be at the heart of this. What is that?
Yeah, so I hadn't ever heard this term, and a lot of close observers of the NYPD's practices hadn't either until we started asking questions about it. It basically means that an officer is, quote, dismissed from the New York City Police Department, but that penalty is suspended for a year, so it's not actually implemented. They continue to arrest people. They continue to go to work. And at the end of that year, their probation is up, and they continue to do their work as normal. So it's a strange practice that doesn't seem to have a whole lot of teeth for the officers involved.
And 319 officers is not even the entire universe of probations. That's what you've reported on, because I assume that's the amount of records that you got, but the universe of this seems much broader.
Yeah, I mean, there are hundreds more cases, even from the limited time period we were able to report on, which was 2011 through 2015. But we don't know what's been happening in 2016, 2017, or to the other officers during that period who got similar penalties.
Well, one of the other features of this system, Kendall, that you reported on is what appears to be just a haphazard application. I mean, you report some stunning inconsistency in the way these dismissal probations are used across the department.
Yeah, so one of the things that Mike Hayes, my co-reporter, and I found was that officers kept telling us they thought there was no rhyme or reason to how NYPD implements its penalties. One officer we wrote about was named Damon Porter, and he actually agreed to provide us with his disciplinary file. And it showed that the judge had found him guilty, the judge being an internal NYPD judge, of relatively minor misconduct. The most serious offenses were being discourteous to a supervisor and failing to properly investigate one case. And the judge said, I think you should get this wonky penalty, dismissal, probation, but be allowed to stay on the force. Ray Kelly, who was the NYPD top commissioner at the time, decided that his conduct was so egregious, he should be pushed off the force, even though he was just a year away from being able to retire with a much better pension. Ray Kelly, 9 months later, decided that an officer who'd beat a man with a baton and lied to internal affairs investigators about a separate incident shouldn't be fired and should stay on the force. So it seems that there's just a huge array of offenses that can land an officer in trouble with the NYPD, and not a lot of consistency, at least from the outside where we're all sitting, about how they do it.
And what do you think the system does to the police themselves? There are tens of thousands of officers in New York. What does your reporting reflect about how they think this affects their ability to do their jobs? Because most of them, the vast majority of them, are not lawbreakers.
Right. I think it really brings public questions about the entire department, whereas transparency would allow the public to tell the difference between officers who are getting in trouble and the officers who aren't. But as it stands now, we really don't know whether the cop who's arresting me today or arresting you tomorrow is someone who we shouldn't trust.
And is there any pressure in the state of New York to get rid of this secrecy and have a public reporting system where people can know when and if officers are disciplined?
There is pressure. There's a bill right now in the state legislature to try and bring more transparency to police misconduct records. But bills like this have faced a lot of opposition in New York. The biggest union in New York City has fought against them. The department itself has said it's supportive of changes that would allow it to share more information, but has also taken steps to reduce transparency in recent years. So I think it's really unclear what's going to happen and whether or not this is going to change anytime soon.
Kendall Taggart, investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News, reported the story along with Mike Hayes at BuzzFeed. Kendall, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Chessie Prout was a 15-year-old freshman at St. Paul's Private School in Concord, New Hampshire, when a senior classmate took her to a secluded room on campus and sexually assaulted her. It was part of a grim ritual on campus at St. Paul's called the Senior Salute, where older students try to achieve sexual conquests with freshmen. Chessie's attacker was then 18-year-old Owen LaBrie. LaBrie was convicted of misdemeanor sexual assault charges in August of 2015 and a felony computer charge, but acquitted of felony rape charges. He was sentenced to 1 year in prison and forced to register as a sex offender in New Hampshire. Chessie Prout is now 19 years old, and she's made it her mission to tell her story.
So I wanted to add some humanity and light to the word victim and survivor. And I wanted to help tell my story of empowerment and how I seek justice, to help inspire other young people to let them know that they can do the same.
Chessie's written a new account of the experience with Jen Abelson, investigative reporter with the Boston Globe Spotlight team. The book is called I Have the Right To, and Prout and Abelson joined us to talk about their hope for this story. I asked Chessie Prout first to take us back and describe the aftermath of the attack.
Well, one of the things that bothered me the most about the crime itself was that I didn't know it was a crime at the time. I thought I was being too sensitive. I blamed myself for not kicking or screaming. But it's common for survivors to freeze in the moment. There's flight, fight, or freeze. And I froze. And so after hearing other stories from other students, I started to realize that this was not my fault. And that this really wasn't okay. And the fact that my sister was able to tell me that this was not my fault really solidified that for me and helped me be able to report the crime committed against me.
You also got a text message from a friend, a mutual friend of you and your assailant at school after the attack, sort of acknowledging that something bad had happened, but trying to talk you down from taking it seriously as a crime, or at least that's what it seemed like.
Yes. I mean, I believe people find it really difficult to believe that a boy was capable of doing this, committing a crime like this, they choose to believe that a girl was overreacting over a boy capable of committing a crime like this because it's easier.
Jen, you've spent a lot of time studying boarding schools, and I don't know that we want to confine this to just boarding schools, but how common is a case like Chessie's, as well as the stigma and the reaction that she got when word of this assault spread at school?
I think that the senior salute was a particular tradition to St. Paul's, but it exists, I think, in different formats in a variety of different schools, whether it's scoring girls, maps, rating girls by numbers. It's sort of all this, you know, this attempt to sexually conquest girls. And I think for Chessie, it was at St. Paul's, the tradition involved seniors pursuing or older students pursuing younger students. What was so horrifying for Chessie, and I think she was talking about in the trial, learning that they had targeted her for months. And this was part of a larger scheme against her. And I think you find it in private schools was where I had had my focus at. And you found this very insular world where kids were allowed to sort of live incredibly independently, and adults weren't really watching over these students as much as they should have been. But the issues Chessie talks about in terms of consent and healthy relationships, many schools are not addressing those with young kids, with kids who need to be learning about that in high school, in middle school, whether or not touching is appropriate. And I think that that was sort of the larger message we wanted to bring to this book and in trying to talk about this.
Chessie, when you arrived at St. Paul's, was there instruction or guidance in terms of appropriate relationships between students?
No, there wasn't. It was more along the lines of inappropriate things may happen. Boys may try to do this to you. They may try to touch you at dances. Just ignore it. Don't take part in it. And that's not possible because we don't want to take part in it most of the time, and it's done on us forcibly. And it's not happening at these schools, and I believe it's so important for them to start talking about, for everyone to start talking about the importance of consent and respecting other people's bodies.
How did adults around campus react, Chessie? You write in this book extensively about how other students reacted, some supportive, many with ridicule, stigma, singling you out on social media and in other ways. What about the adults around campus? How did they react?
Well, the instruction from the school was don't talk about it, don't address the victim. And they did that with the, you know, fake idea of supporting me, giving me privacy by not talking about it and not addressing the problem at the school. So I only interacted with a few teachers who I was close with, who were family friends of mine and who knew my parents and my sister. But other than that, the silence from the adults was deafening.
Jen, is that common at the private schools that you've studied where adults go into self-protection mode? At least that's what it sounds like in Chessie's case, that under the guise of supporting her, there was a lot of self-protection for the school going on.
I believe that's a very common response and has been for decades at these schools. We found that adults would turn a blind eye, in fact, in some cases, cover up for predators. A lot of what I looked at was adult to student, but similarly student to student. They tried to make the problem go away quietly, sometimes pushing bad teachers or students out the door quietly to other private schools where they could go on to commit similar crimes.
And Jen, let's talk about accountability. The boy, the assailant, was named Owen, got 1 year on a misdemeanor sexual misconduct charge. Do I have that right? Was not put on trial for felony assault. What did accountability look like in this case?
I think the jury came back and convicted him on 5 of the 9 charges. One was a felony computer charge, and that has required him to register for life as a sex offender. There are the other, as you mentioned, felony rape charges he wasn't convicted of. But I do think it's important to say that during the sentencing, the judge addressed the courtroom and said that he did not find that Chessie had consented to the encounter. And I think in a lot of these cases, you see sort of juries end up coming and splitting the verdict. These are complicated cases, but I think from Chessie's point of view and my point of view, it was actually quite simple. She said no.
And Chessie, the legal issues might be complex, or the whether one lawyer got over on another lawyer. In the end, in terms of accountability for Owen, how did you feel about the verdict and the punishment that he faced?
Either way, I thought the ending is sad because he did this to me, and that can never be taken away. That can never be taken away or amended or fixed by a verdict, by anything. And he's being punished for it. Some days I wish that this had never happened to me, but now I'm starting to see that I can accept that this happened to me. I know that it's not going away, but I can use the anger and pain that I've felt from this to empower myself and other survivors to seek justice and to change the status quo of shaming and blaming survivors to lifting them up and supporting them.
That's Chessie Prout, a former student at St. Paul's School in New Hampshire, a survivor of sexual assault, and author of I Have a Right To, along with Jen Abelson, who's an investigative reporter on the Spotlight team at the Boston Globe. Chessie, Jen, thank you both so much for being here and for sharing your story, Chessie.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Well, later this week, we'll be talking about women who've made major contributions to our country, but whose stories have gone largely unrecognized. It's Women's History Month, and we want to hear from you on this. Is there a woman, past or present, whose life story you think deserves a wider audience? Give it to us. Call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE, to tell us her story. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.